outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson, and I want to welcome you to this edition of The God Journey, a special one it is, too. I've got people who we've had on before. Joining us again are Nita Taylor and Bob Prater. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's
Thank you. Appreciate it, Wayne.
It's great to join you. The book's about to come out, The Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation. In fact, they were printing yesterday, I heard. So they're going to be hot off the presses shortly, though they still need to be bound and boxed and shipped and all that. November 19 is the date. I forget when, because I've been down this circus a few times. This is the first time for both of you to have a book with your name on the cover. What's that feel like?
It's a little bit surreal. So, you know, I look at the book cover and I just kind of, sometimes I look away and then I go, oh my goodness, that's all three of my names on that book. You know, it's just kind of overwhelming. But it's a great feeling to have an opportunity to just share a part of my voice. My friends have heard this kind of talk for years. I think they're probably going to be glad it's finally in a bound version so I can stop.
I don't think you'll stop at all, Arnita, to be honest. Bob, what are you thinking?
Yeah, it's surreal's a great word to describe the way it felt. It was, I still look at it and go, this cannot be true. And you warned us, Wayne, you warned me at least, and said there's quite a feeling that you get the first time you see your name on a book.
Yeah,
you weren't lying.
No, and you haven't seen the books yet. I think it'll even be a different experience when you finally see it. Me, I'm just kind of always relieved now the book's finally out. But I remember the first time still when I was actually, quote unquote, a published author. It was a bigger deal back then than it feels now to me. But I'm excited for you guys. I'm excited to... November 19th is the release date for those of you that haven't been paying attention to our blogs and all the other stuff that we're putting out there. November 19th is the date. You can pre-order it now. We'll have a link at the bottom if you want to do that. We're also assembling a launch team via Facebook for those of you that would like to help us get the social media word out. I think by the time this airs, you could still probably hop into that, but you at least get an early reading of the book and a chance to explore some of the fun videos and things that kind of behind this book for us. So.
Wait a minute. Now, fun is a relative word here.
Did you feel a little picked on?
It's all fun.
Because literally, both videos that you've placed online in that group, Wayne, have been at one person's expense and one person only.
But you made the cut, Bob. You made the cut. Oh, your name is on the cover. We did not vote you out of the book.
Well, I appreciate that. Since the book was my idea.
It's your idea.
Thanks. I'm glad I didn't get booted out of my own book.
You didn't get booted out of your own idea.
My gosh.
You know, the only fun videos I had of us attacking you, Bob. So, I mean, I don't have anything else. Otherwise,
well, unfortunately, that's a common experience. If most people, you know, wanted to put something regarding me, it will be at my expense somewhere along the line. Trust me.
But we love your difference. We love the difference that you bring to the table.
You're too kind.
I just hate that you say it's at your expense, because that to me is always bad humor if it's at someone else's expense. Genuinely.
Oh no. Yeah. I mean, look, it was very good-hearted and good-natured. It was just, you know, me with my fake anger and faux surprise at what was happening
but the bug was funny. You got to admit the bug was funny.
The bug
Look,
was hilarious.
The bug, I would have cleared the whole house if the bug had come out. People don't understand the size. You know, when there's a 3.5-inch bug from the outside looking like it can get in the room, that's a problem for me. That's a problem.
Well, it's also one more reason to not be in Texas, FYI. But you know, I guess it's true. Everything really is bigger in Texas, including bugs.
I would love to have seen Arnita come off that diva chair with the anxiety of that bug being in the room.
No, sir. That is not something you would have wanted to witness.
I think I would have, and I'm not sure you'd let us play the video.
No, I promise you, I probably would have stripped down if I had thought that bug was on me.
Oh my God.
It's not going to work out.
This is a PG-rated podcast.
I'm keeping it real. Oh. A bug on me? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me read to you one of the quotes that we put in the front part of this book, and maybe just kind of explore from this a little bit, some of what is in the book for us, for what we think there. And this is Brené Brown's quote from Daring Greatly. "Doesn't matter if the group is a church or a gang or a sewing circle or masculinity itself, asking members to dislike, disown, or distance themselves from another group of people as a condition of belonging is always about control and power. I think we have to question the intentions of any group that insists on disdain toward other people as a membership requirement." Again, from Brené Brown, Daring Greatly. Man, what do you guys think of that?
Well, I think that it's a stunning statement in its clarity and absolute reality. I also love the quote in the first chapter from Anne Lamott about you can be sure that you've created God in your own image when he hates all the same people you do. Those types of thoughts where we hold people in lockstep and we threaten them with expulsion from the group if they don't, you know, fall in line, is incendiary. It's the dark side of tribalism, isn't it?
Yeah, I would agree. I just think when we look at exclusion, which is what we're promoting when we say some people can't be in the group, exclusion is always learned. And I think one of the dark sides of exclusion is people don't ever realize how poor you really are in relationships when you don't have different people coming into your life and experiencing life with them. Now, for some people, that's a choice. But for other people, it's just not something they're cognizant of. They just don't know that they're being exclusive like that. But if I ever join anything and they tell me, well, you know, it's good for these people and not for that people, I'm always going to look at that up front as something of probably not lining up with my values to be a part of. So
yeah,
it's an individual thing at the end of the day.
Yeah. Let me throw a story out there that's not in the book. But when I was in the eighth grade and we were living in Roseburg, Oregon, a very small rural town of 15,000 in Oregon, there were two twins that came into our city and started going to our school, and they were poorer than us. They were the real poor kids, and their clothes were sometimes dirty and stained, and boy, we all made fun of them. And then the summer came, and the sister became friends with one of my sisters. And so the brother started coming over to my house, and we became really good friends during the summer. And then it was the first day of school, eighth grade. And we were at this community bus stop, as rural areas tend to be. They don't come to each house. So we all went to a rural bus stop. There were probably 50 kids waiting to get on the bus. And this guy comes and stands next to me, because I'm now his friend.
Oh.
And I will never forget one of the cool kids that I was part of at that point in time said, Crater, you're not friends with this guy, are you?
Oh.
And I turned, and in one of the most shameful moments of my life, because I wanted so badly to belong, I turned and looked at him and I said, hell no. And just to drive the point home, because I was so dysfunctional, I punched him in the face.
Oh my gosh.
Oh wow.
This is a terrible story. He picked himself up, tears running down his face, and went back to his place at the back of the line. I will never forget that. It haunts me. I have been trying to find this man for all of my adult life to try to apologize, because I never did apologize as a kid. And I don't know how his life turned out, but I would imagine probably not very well. And I had an opportunity to be the difference for this guy, but because of peer pressure. Now, granted, I was just a kid, but because of peer pressure and the threat of exclusion, I did what I had to do. Does that make sense?
No, I have a similar story. When I was younger, and the Sunday school was having a contest for bringing new people, and I was trying to talk some of my friends into coming to Sunday school with me, who I knew I didn't go to church anywhere. And after I got done talking, they went away. This one kid who'd been listening on the conversation, who was you know, he wasn't poor in the sense you're talking, but he was a little bit awkward and really wasn't anybody's friend at school. And he came up and said, I'd love to go to Sunday school with you. And I remember, I said, well, I'll get back to you on it, whatever. And I never did because I just would have been embarrassed to come into Sunday school with this kid.
Mm.
And so, yeah, that's very, I didn't punch him in the face or nothing, but
right.
I look back at moments like that when it's just the whole idea of who you hang out with says how cool you are.
Right.
And there are certain kids, I think of that story and I think of another girl in class that everybody made fun of because of her last name, because she came from one of the families you talked about. And I look back on those stories from my childhood and there is a deep regret in my heart that I wasn't wholer back then. And I don't mean I beat myself up over it, but just realize, my gosh, I wouldn't treat people the same way today. I would hope not, but I did.
Well,
certainly.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but I'm telling you, as an adult, I realized that at that point in time, I held a young man's life in my hands and had an opportunity to align with him and be a friend when he needed a friend.
Yeah.
And instead, I didn't just do the opposite. I knocked him down to the ground. You have to know, I have looked for him for 25 years and I can't find him. I mean, I don't even know. Your mind goes in certain places, like whatever happened, right. Were they able to recover?
Well, hopefully you'll get to find him. Maybe this book can be a catalyst for him, maybe finding you or vice versa.
Or he may just happen to listen to this podcast. I mean, strange.
He may just hear this.
The story you had this morning, Arnita, of someone you just met.
Isn't that amazing?
By happenstance in a store, has become a real advocate for the book.
I think it's amazing. It's just how God connects people. Literally, I was in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in a Sprouts, and I saw this lady with her kids looking at Larabars. We were doing the Whole 30 food program, and so Larabars is like the only thing you can have that even tastes like sugar. So you kind of freak out.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But you can't have all the Larabars. And so we're in the store, and I just started talking to her over Larabars. Well, later we came out of the store, we became Facebook friends, and we shared our family photos, and they were very similar. Like, they almost look like we could have taken them at the same set. Mm. And so it's so sweet. This morning I get a tag post from Facebook that she tells the story of us meeting over Larabars and Sprouts in Tennessee, and she shares the book, and she says, let's share hope, you know, go out and let's share hope so that we can be better as a community. And I love that. Wow. It's just, that's amazing. Someone I've had one conversation with in my life, thought it was relevant to do that and share it. So I'm really excited about it.
That's wonderful.
It's a great story. So,
you know, I think about this quote from Brené Brown and Disdain, and we think about excluding people from groups. I was had a number of conversations over this last trip I had to Florida where we get into some political area. Because if the book comes up, then people want to take me to where they're at in terms of the political angst going on in D.C. these days, over particularly this impeachment's kind of hot and the whole thing with China and Hong Kong and the NBA and all that's kind of hot. So I get a lot of conversations like that. I noticed the people, because this Disdain word has come up through this quote. We talked about it when we talked about including this quote. And you can just hear it in someone's voice when they have absolute disdain for people they consider to be on the other side of what they want. And a lot of that disdain, particularly in one man's case, I probably talked for 2 hours about his, he's a real pro-Trump guy, and just trying to talk through his feeling about all of that and where we disagree on some of it and where we agree on some of it. And his disdain comes from feeling the disdain of the, say, for lack of a better word, the liberal leftist elites, East Coast media. He feels like we've been, you know, the deplorables. He feels like they've been badgered with that language for so long that he celebrates when the president uses it against other groups of people. And that's really the whole source of why he feels like that disdain is justified, because I've been the victim of it so long from so many groups that I applaud when he gives it back to him. Even if it's beyond the pale, and even if it's going to diminish conversations in the country, it's worth it. And that's, to me, the whole disdain train, if you want to say that. Once you get on that with people, we've done that in relationships, I guess, where you kind of freeze somebody out of your affection because you're upset at something they've done, and then they freeze you out, and then it just keeps growing and growing. And man, that's the stuff I hope people can at least stop and take a look at and say, that's another human being over there. And you may disagree with them, and you may not like what they've done to you, but it's not going to change if you just do it back.
Very true. You know, disdain is such a heart condition. It's such a heart thing. You know, I hate that everybody makes everything so political, because A Language of Healing is not just a political book. It's a book to help you identify why you have disdain in lots of areas, if you have it. So it's more of a, that's certainly a part of it, but disdain is such a deeply seated belief, if you have it, in my opinion, that you know, you just have to, why is that? You know, am I threatened because people are different? Am I scared because people are different? Why do you have no bandwidth for anyone who's different? And I think that's an individual question. And my hope in the book is that it breaks down people one heart, one mind at a time, because systems are made of people.
Yep.
Groups are made of people. It has to start somewhere. And Bob, back to your story about youth, I think it's phenomenal that we have a book out here now, in November, where people can teach their children this. Yep. Because really, it's got to start at a youth age. You know, sometimes I get tired of talking to older people. They're so set in their ways. Now, we'll chip away at a few things. But for youth people and people who are raising our youth for tomorrow, this is a great message, a great tool to be able to use to help bring some of those conversations in. I do think people just get tired, Wayne, and start reacting with disdain because they're just so tired of one way. I do get that, though. I get that. I've been there before.
I get it too. Yeah. I think when you feel like everything's aligned against you and no one's really listening and understanding you, then it's easy to turn around and start treating other people the same way. It's just like everything, though. It takes a brave person to stop that cycle. You know,
right.
It's like if I've been treated poorly, then I'm going to treat back poorly. And that just escalates. We've got that in the Middle East. We've got that everywhere around the world. But someone has to break the chain, and someone has to begin to say, okay, this is going to be generous on my part because I don't think I've been treated fairly, but generosity is a great way to change the world.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh. Is it ever. So Wayne and I are close generationally. We're only a couple of years apart. And so when you bring up youth, Arnita, and hope for younger people, I haven't given up hope for my own generation, but I've been reading this man, Eric Erickson, who was a psychotherapist or psycho something. He was psycho back in, I think, the 1930s. And he writes about the eight stages of life. And this fascinated me because he said from the years 45 to 65, that's stage seven of eight. And he said, you either have generativity stagnation. And so many of my generation have chosen stagnation. They have chosen, rather than generating new things in their life, they have chosen to stay where they are, to be comfortable. And if you choose that, if stagnation is your reality for those years, once you get beyond 65, you're in the last stage of life, stage eight, and there are only two choices there, integrity or despair.
Wow.
And when I look at this, it's like every piece falls into place for me, because so much of my generation has chosen comfort over, values. We have chosen to just, we lock ourselves away in our homes. We're seeing it in the political world. We're seeing it in every aspect of society, where these are the get off my lawn people. The people that young people really don't want to have anything to do with, and they really don't want to. These are the ones that say, those damn millennials or whatever. But we make choices between those middle years of 45 to 65, whether we want to continue to move forward. That's why this is so exciting for me, because this is forward movement. And those who choose to move forward, I always think about Eugene Peterson, who died just a few years ago in his mid-80s, but he was still doing the stuff. You would not call his life despair. You would call it completely integrity. And I'm a fan of that.
Yeah. I have not, you know, seen Mr. Erickson's research or anything. Despair is such a strong word.
It is.
You know, that's such a strong, hopeless word
it to is.
Me, in my opinion. And so, I don't know, but this is what I know. As a development person, I believe that most people can be more growth-minded than they are. You just have to choose to be. And normally when people are stagnant, they have ceased to see the need to grow.
Right.
They just have. And so I'm hoping, it is certainly my hope and prayer, that we can just help some people go forward in one or two steps. Again, our book is very vast. It covers a lot of different things. We have 15 chapters in a book of 15 great conversations. If people can get like a couple of things from two of the chapters, it's a win for us, because that's going to push some people outside of their comfort zone and to grow. And we talk about it in the book. In order to receive some of this, you got to be growth minded. I remember Wayne in the introduction, we said, hey, this book won't be for everybody.
For sure.
Yeah, it won't be for everybody, but it's capable of being for everyone if you have the mindset to move forward and not just kind of check out with disdain, as you just said, Bob.
Yeah, I remember when I was given the option, I think by God, to leave the group I'd been a part of when they were announced my resignation one Sunday. And the phrase in my head was, I identified as God later, I have more to teach you if you walk away than if you stay. And one of my arguments with that was, what more do I have to learn? And, you know, I'm 42.
There you go.
I've got it all figured out. I know exactly. I'm just going to coast now into, you know, doing what I'm already comfortable doing. And I've never heard of these eight stages or whatever. But to me, the most engaging people I know, even people in their 80s and 90s, are people who are still growing. They're people who are still discovering. They've not camped down in their own despair, I think is a big word, but even just other than integrity, just crotchetiness, you know, just feeling all crotchety, and they're kind of out of sorts, and they're demanding, and they have high expectations for people. And when they don't meet it, they distance themselves from people. Those are not the fun people to hang out with in your older ages.
That's an understatement.
The people that you love to hang out with are people that are still asking questions, still discovering. So it's like, hey, this is what happened to me yesterday. And they're excited about some new insight that's going to change the way they think. And, you know, you'd think you'd nail all that down by the time you graduate from high school, but you haven't even begun to start a journey yet.
Oh, my goodness. That's so true. They're not fun people to hang out with. That's probably going to be the best sentence on the whole podcast.
So
that's
hilarious. Be fun to hang out with. That's what I want to be. I'm 66, and man, I hang out with people of a variety of ages, variety of backgrounds, variety of political leanings, and it's fun to be someone who's in a conversation, still discovering, still enjoying what others are discovering. And I think that's kind of the spirit. If people who want to read this book could start there, just, hey, how will this help me grow? And I don't want to be done growing. And I don't want to just camp out where my heart is comfortable. I really want to see what more I can do to add to the quality of life for other people around me.
Sure. And getting back to when you said, you know, sometimes you're the first person to say this needs to happen. Courage, man. Courage is a big part of this. Often when you're the one person who steps out, you know, people reject you. Nobody comes near you. And so you really have to have it as an internal value when you're going to do that, because you're going to need that value to keep you in the middle of the game. But I do think it takes a lot of courage. And often the people who step out are not real popular, at least not at first. We need to help people, give people permission to grow. Some people don't think they can grow anymore. You'd be surprised. Some of those people who are stagnant, they just don't think there's anything else, not even from an arrogant perspective. They just don't feel like, well, there's probably nothing else for me to grow toward. So I hope this book gives people permission to review and look at everything and reflect on their life differently. You can still grow. You're permitted to grow where you decide you want to grow. But you're absolutely right.
Or it's old dog, new trick stuff, right? It's like I just got to a certain age and decide, well, I'm that way about some new internet apps. I'm just like, I really don't want to go down that road. And you guys are forcing me into Instagram right now, so that's a real challenge for me.
Oh, my gosh. And we are watching you squirm, man.
Because I decided a long time ago I just didn't need any more apps to be involved with. But I'm violating that even as we speak. So
yeah, thanks, Anna.
But it's
thanks,
also
what
you said about helping other people grow. I noticed when Sarah went through a major transition in her heart 7 years ago, God just unplugged some things in my wife that we neither one of us knew were there. And that required her to change. That also required me to change to make room for her changes. And
that's good.
We told that story on a podcast. And I can't tell you the number of women I've talked to since that really identify with Sarah's story and really want to go on a different growth journey, and their husbands are against it. Look, I married you this way. I'm comfortable with this way. I don't want you to change. And they just feel so hemmed in with people around them who want to put them in the same box they've always been in because it makes them comfortable.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad we included that chapter. It wasn't my favorite chapter working on it, but that chapter about being disruptive. Because growth is disruptive, and learning a language of healing is not just sitting around singing Kumbaya all the time. It really is honest engagements that, particularly this one guy I was talking about earlier, I was on. We had some very tense conversations as I kept trying to move him from at least help him see his own biases that probably were not serving him well. So I wasn't just arguing with him. I was trying to draw him into a different conversation. And the last 10 minutes of this conversation that we had were the best 10 minutes. He finally softened enough to be honest about what he was dealing with really on the inside. And I just thought, man, that's amazing. It kind of took 2 hours to work our way down to a more honest and authentic conversation. But at times, because I wouldn't just go along with him, I kept saying, you know what? I understand what you're saying, but let me tell you how I see it. And some of that would just rile him up again. But eventually, he began to buy into a little, I mean, it was just a chink in the armor, but it was a little bit. It was a little bit of difference.
Right.
And the conversation became gentler.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I mean. I hope this book chips away at people's paradigms. We may never change anyone's mind totally, but certainly I hope that we chip away, just like what you're describing with your friend, in some of the beliefs and thoughts that people have. I think that's a real start. That's really a blessing.
Me too.
We can do that. So,
no, it is. And as you're telling that story about sitting with that man in Florida, I think what drew him in that final 10 minutes was your kindness. I'm finding that the kinder I am, the hungrier people around me become for the real, the more it moves them off of, you know, whatever it is that they think is, you know, that they have to be. If I'm kind, all of a sudden the people around me become kind. It's just funny how that works. And the more I do that, the more people respond positively.
Yeah. Part of that is maybe just, it's no fun to be really angry alone. Anger really wants somebody to fight back.
Right.
And you don't feign agreement. That's what a lot of people do to disarm anger. They just pretend to agree. But when you're not, when you still disagree and you're still honest, but you're gentle and kind about it, it really is. I mean, I don't think it just suddenly changed. I think 2 hours was chipping away. at a different way of communicating that took him a while to embrace. And I don't know if he still would today because he's pretty passionate about some of his views. But Bob, one of the stories you tell in the book, and I related this story probably 15 times on this trip, in various ways, just sharing with people. But you talked about being a judge and judging people and then recusing. Could you talk about that? I know it's in the book. People get it there. But I think that's such a powerful analogy.
For me, I have, you know, I spent many of my younger years. The world was very black and white to me. And so it was very easy for me to make determinations and make judgments. And
you're not
so
talking racially black and white, are you, Bob?
Oh my gosh! No, no,
of course
no!
Not. I mean, I'm on the line.
Yeah,
I was expecting you to say something, Arnita, but
no! I let people be themselves for a minute.
Okay, okay, well, as long as I'm not hanging myself for a minute.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good and evil. Maybe we'd say good and evil.
Good and evil, cut and dried. Yeah. There was no place for middle ground. You're either in or you're out. You're either right or you're wrong. But as I began to let myself fall in love with people, that was a big deal. As I began to ask myself these lenses of experience, when I began to take those off and I asked the Lord for a year every day, give me the lenses of heaven and let me see creation the way that you see it. And after a year, it became second nature. I don't have to ask him anymore. I just do. And when I see through his eyes a little bit, I begin to see people as if they're part of my family. And if I were a judge on a bench in robes, and one of my family members, one of my daughters, is brought before me, I would have no choice but to recuse myself and step off the bench because I'm too close and I love her too much to make judgment. And so if I love her and I love my neighbor and I love creation, then I would much rather be the person standing next to the broken and the accused as an advocate rather than a judge. Wow. So that's what I attempt to do.
That's such a powerful analogy. People see that, you know, when you talk about you can't judge, even legally, even in our culture, broken culture, especially in our broken culture, you can't judge what you love. You have to get a stranger to do the judging.
Sure. Yep.
Just so it's unbiased. The hope that it is. And I love
because once you start to judge, the love is gone. It's gone. You cannot love what you judge harshly. You cannot.
And a good judge has to be dispassionate a bit. So I can't do it anymore. I can't do it anymore. And it has been a life-changing lesson for me to realize that I do get to wholeheartedly be an advocate. I get to be their attorney. I get to be the one that pleads their case. And that is a much higher call than being a judge.
And that's part of the incarnation, right? The John 3:16, which we all know really well, and the John saying, for the Son of Man did not come to judge.
Right.
He couldn't love everybody. He couldn't love the people he loved if he was going to be focused on their failures and mistakes and problems and issues. And man, that's the example I would hope we would embrace. But my growing up in religion taught me, if we go back to the word disdain, it taught me to disdain people who weren't following the God I knew. There was a home team and an away team. And we use love as a weapon, and by love as affection. We always said we loved everybody, and we love the sinner and hate the sin. We said all that, but we didn't mean it. We actually had disdain for people who were getting away with sinful stuff that we didn't feel like we were allowed to do. And so I notice this when I'm with various people as I travel, you can always tell religious people.
Absolutely.
Because they have this disdain and they're willing to use love as a weapon. So if I have a problem with you, I withdraw my affection. I just go into my little cave. I just pretend you don't exist. And I've got people who do that to me. And I'm always shocked going, really? You're going to break up this relationship simply because of a misunderstanding or because you've reached a conclusion that I haven't reached. And yet I know I was taught that in the Christianity club I grew up in, that you disdain what you don't embrace. And you actually withdraw your affection from people as a means to control them to better behavior. Hmm. And it's such a fallacy.
Yeah, sure. Because, you know, that's legalism. Legalism never errs on the side of love. It's almost juxtaposition. It almost cannot. So that's what you're talking about. Hey, I got my own legalism stories. I think we talk a little bit about them in the bias chapter. That was probably my main area of bias was in religion and church world. And it just got reinforced. You know, my little judgmentalism got reinforced because of where I went to church. So
yeah, I did.
We are taught early in religion, especially the Christian religion, what fellowship has light with darkness? And boy, if ever a scripture was used inappropriately, because Jesus was hanging out with sinners all the time, it was one of the main complaints about him. What's he doing with those people? But I was taught what fellowship has light with darkness. Like, you know, if even Mormons come to your door, don't even engage them. Don't say God bless you. Nothing. just send them on their way, because, you know, what fellowship has light with darkness? Now, these days, when people come to my door, they get me.
Oh, boy.
I literally, when they come to my door, if something sparks, I'm collecting phone numbers and buying breakfast.
That's great.
Of course, because you are.
Because it's what I do. And I'm telling you, God has used that. I had a couple of Mormon missionaries that came, and I said, "What are we doing, boys?" And they said, "Well, we're telling people the good news of Jesus Christ." And I said, "I ain't got no issue with that. I said, I like it. So tell me what this is." And the next thing you know, we're sitting at a restaurant a couple of weeks later. And I began to just have conversation with these two young ones. And as I'm just talking to them, both of them burst into tears.
Oh,
because they've never heard the things. They've never encountered him the way that they were encountering him that day. But that never would have happened had I not just stepped through that scripture that said, what fellowship does light have with darkness, and invited people who look at the world and religion differently than me,
yeah,
and invite them to my table. Hey, come on, let me just buy you a meal. It was one of the best days of my life.
So fun.
And probably one of the underlying themes that you're not saying, Bob, and I just kind of know you, is, you know, we have got to deal with irrational fear in our lives.
Yep.
We have got to deal with that. You know, God gave us some fear, just, you know, flight or fight responses and that kind of thing. But irrational fear, just to be afraid of people, I don't know where that is being perpetuated. And I do know where some of it comes from, particularly in our country. But individually dealing with your level of irrational fear is going to help this. You would not go toward a closed-in meeting with Mormons if you were afraid of them. Why are we fearful as people of God? Why is that a thing? So we do talk a little bit about fear in the book, but that's just always got to be an underlying current there. How afraid are you of people? You know, everybody's the same.
And I don't see any of that fear taking place in the life of Jesus. He encountered people who were different all the time, whether it was Samaritans or, you know, whether it was religious leaders or whether it was common folk. He was willing to engage at every level. Yes. And that's got to be the template, right?
It's amazing, right, how much we miss that, though, because I grew up with the same in the religious construct I grew up in. There's a home team and an away team, and
right. The
home team God blesses. And even when you feel like you're on the away team, you hold disdain for yourself. I mean, the whole contempt for sin and all that stuff that we were taught kind of spills over into other people who are wrestling with similar things. And we seem to neglect the scripture when Jesus says, love your enemies, which in Luke 6, he says, love your enemies, those you perceive as your enemy, for even God is kind and gracious to the wicked and the ungrateful. Now,
yeah.
I don't know how many years it went before I actually read that verse for what it was. Even God is kind and gracious to the wicked and the ungrateful. And if we could wrap our heads around that, we couldn't use love as a weapon. We couldn't give it to people who do what we want and withhold it from people who don't. We would just have love. And if you're in a place like, Bob, what you're talking, when you're no longer threatened about your own theology or beliefs, you can sit down with people who see just the opposite of you and not have any need to feel threatened by what they're going through, but just be kind and gracious and no less honest, but kind and gracious in it as well.
That's exactly right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, we're arriving at the end of this. We are going to release the book officially November 16 and 17 in Dallas, Texas. Arnita, you're hosting us down there to release this book.
I am hosting you in Dallas, Texas. I'm excited about it. Getting a whole lot of inquiries and stuff, but we're going to have it in the North Richland Hills area.
Okay.
At an event venue, and everybody can go to the official languageofhealing.com website to RSVP to reserve your spot. And we'll be there talking. We're going to have Tracy Levinson MC it. And it's just going to be a fun time, you know, just a time for us to talk a little bit like we're talking now and meet people and sign some books and eat some cake. You know, we got to have cake.
And on the 16th, we're talking about doing a 6-hour training where we're going to help people.
Sure. We're going to, yeah, something like a little pop-up seminar. It will be held at the Northwood Church in Keller, Texas. And if you're interested in that, you can RSVP on the website. We'll have capacity for about 40 people, and you'll get all three of us in a room, and we're just going to reason together and put our minds together.
And if you want to come in from out of the area, you're more than welcome to come in and join us, like some of you did for the Shack thing out here, the Shack premiere. And that the website is alanguageofhealing.com. So get the A in there, and we'll have a link at the bottom of this. And then the following weekend, the 23rd and 24th, we're going to release it out here in Los Angeles, Southern California area. Hey, Bob?
Yeah, it's going to be wonderful. We're going to be at my alma mater, Life Pacific University in San Dimas, on that Saturday. That will be emceed by Dr. Jim Adams, who is the former president of Life Pacific and a wonderful man and someone who endorsed the book. There's space for about 100 people, and that will just be a celebration, some Q&A. And then the next day, we've got another event, don't we, Arnita?
Yes, we do. We're going to be having conversations in color with a group called Culture Brave in the Los Angeles area. Miss Lisa Vitella is the leader of that group, and we're still working out the location, but we will be in the LA area on that Sunday afternoon. So we'll make sure that that information is added to the website as soon as possible.
Okay. Well, I think that'll just about do it. We're looking. We get a lot of requests when I was in Florida about doing an audio recording of the book. So that's something else that we're going to be working on around that time frame as well. So hopefully we'll get that done.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Well, thanks, guys, for joining me today.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.